For the Friday Gallery Talk, we have Jackie Serwer from the National Museum of African American History and Culture, and that's Smithsonian's newest museum. They're actually doing a groundbreaking ceremony next week, and it will be scheduled to open in 2015. But right now, you can see some of their exhibitions at the American History Museum, sort of across the mall and diagonal from us. So we're excited to have her here today to talk about these three Jacob Lawrence paintings, which are in the Hirshhorn's permanent collection. Thanks.
Good afternoon, everyone. I would like to thank you also for coming. And I am delighted to have a chance to spend some time in an art gallery. We're just in offices, and though I have a few things in my office, it's not like being in a museum and being able to walk out of your, get up from your desk and walk out and see something absolutely beautiful, as is the case at the Hirshhorn. In any case, let me talk a little bit about, give you a little bit of background on Jacob Lawrence. He is one of the most famous American artists, was born in 1917 and died in 2007, so lived to about 90 years old. He started his career very early on. By the time he was not even 20, he had done his first series of paintings. It was actually the series that I mentioned, devoted to the story of Toussaint Louverture and the Haitian Revolution. He was born in Newark, New Jersey, lived for a while in Philadelphia, and then moved to Harlem, and that proved to be the place where his talent would flourish. But he was not, he wasn't educated in a conventional way. He didn't really like high school. He dropped out fairly early on. But he put himself into a very rich cultural and educational situation. In Harlem at that time, we're talking about the 30s now, during the Depression, but also during the period of the WPA. And in Harlem especially, there were several workshops that catered to young people where would-be artists and talented young folks could come and begin to hone their skills. And this was the case with Jacob Lawrence. He studied with Charles Alston, a very well-known and very accomplished American artist already at that time, also with Augustus Savage, another important African-American artist of the period. And he also was able to avail himself of other cultural resources. He spent a lot of time at the Schomburg Library, and I'm not sure if it was already called the Schomburg or not, but it was a branch of the New York Public Library. And there was, in particular, a wonderful lecturer, a Professor Seifert, who talked about Africa and African art and those traditions, also about things like the Haitian Revolution. And so though Jacob Lawrence, he not really finished high school, it just didn't suit him, he managed to really educate himself, and he became particularly enthralled by the wonderful stories having to do with African American history. And let me start by saying, trying to structure the talk, I had two questions that kept coming to mind, and I'll mention a few reasons why they seemed important to me, and then when we get to our discussion, perhaps you'll want to follow up a little bit. I wondered why it was that he was so successful so early on. I mean, part of it was that he jump-started his career by not going to high school and college and getting a degree in fine arts and so on. But it was also, I think, because he really he had a very clear vision of what he wanted to do early on. I think at this time there was also a desire of the art establishment, especially in New York. It was a pretty liberal art establishment. They were looking to see how there might be a way to make African-American artists more visible, to help them enter the mainstream of American art. And I think Jacob Lawrence, his work in many ways was so accessible. He was so talented almost by birth. His sense of design, his sense of color, his aptitude for design and geometry was really quite remarkable. And I think the fact that his work was often about stories, that made it very accessible. And I think that the powers that be, some of the important people in the art establishment, felt that he might be the perfect vehicle to begin to open up that closed world to the African American art world. And then he started so early that he wasn't even 20 when he did his first series, and before he was 30, he had done several of these historical series. He'd done one on Harry Tubman, one on Frederick Douglass. Pretty soon after that, he had done the Migration series, which is probably the work of art that he is best known for. And that was a series that dealt with the story of African Americans before World War I, moving north to get away from segregation and the legacy of slavery. So before he was 30, that series had been bought by the Museum of Modern Art and by the Phillips Collection. It was 60 panels, and they divided the series in two. It was considered a very pricey work, although they paid only $1,000 for it, if you can imagine. You wouldn't be able to get a little postage stamp piece of one of these paintings for $1,000. And so he was, he had a one artist show at the Museum of Modern Art, and I think his freshness, his what people saw as almost his innocence, because he hadn't been made into a sophisticate by going to art school, all of those things appealed to him. My other question was, there is, well, as we talk more, there were some demons, I think, that haunted Jacob Lawrence by the late 40s when he was still in his 20s. He had some difficulty. He ended up being hospitalized for depression, and so. My question to myself was, what were the things that haunted him and that might have made it difficult for him to maintain his balance at that point? And I think one of those issues was the fact that he became so successful so quickly and so early. People like Augusta Savage and his other teachers, Charles Alston, nor had their contemporaries reached the kind of fame that Lawrence attained so early. He was taken up by one of the trendiest galleries in New York, the Downtown Gallery, and so he was there with Stuart Davis and with other important artists of the time, John Maron, and so I think that must have weighed on him a little bit. But anyway, we'll get your thoughts on that as we move along. Let me start with the two paintings from 1946. You have the gold miners here, and I until someone tells me differently, my assumption is that this is probably a reference to gold mining in South Africa. It turns out that in 1946, there was a huge strike by the black miners. Gold had become, not that it wasn't always sought after, but it became particularly valuable important in terms of building, being used for tools and machinery and so on after World War II. And 21 mines were involved. It was meant to be a peaceful strike, and it ended up being characterized by a very bloody, violent response from the authorities. So my assumption is that this is Lawrence's recognition of that event. According to an expert on South Africa whom I spoke with, this strike was the beginning of the politicization of Nelson Mandela, that he, as a young member of the ANC, was involved in attempting to aid the strikers and to make known to the rest of the world what was going on there. So that seemed very interesting to me. I believe the colors of the ANC are yellow, green, and red. So that may also be a reference to that particular situation. The other painting from 1946 is called The Cabinet Makers, and many of you will know that there are a lot of works by Lawrence that have to do with carpentry or building. There's a series called The Builders, and you may recall from articles in the newspaper that the Jacob Lawrence that was acquired by the White House some years ago was a painting from the Builder series. And for Lawrence, I mean, I think he saw himself as a builder. The way he constructed his paintings, very deliberative. And I think also he saw building and carpentry as a very creative, collaborative activity. And in some ways a kind of metaphor for building and changing and repairing the world. So for him, this wasn't so much about the realism of a scene like this as it would have been about the symbolism of people getting together, skilled people coming, collaborating, and being able to create something that was life-affirming. So that would be my interpretation of this. He was a lifelong collector of tools. And so these are not just incidental, the tools that you see here. They are, for Lawrence, they were almost like artifacts. And he loved them, and he saw workers who did this kind of activity. He saw the tools as extensions of their arms, as being an expression, an extension of their creativity. Also, when he was growing up, he was very close. As I said, since he didn't go to school, he had a lot of mentors and a lot of older folks who looked after him. And there were some well-known carpenters in Harlem known as the Bates brothers, and evidently he was quite close to them. Also, he was one of three children, and his younger brother, William, I discovered was a carpenter. So there are a lot of background details that may have helped to nourish his interest in carpentry and in building. Although that it's more like a brown than a yellow, I was thinking about the fact that he has red, yellow, blue, which are the primary colors and the building blocks of all other colors, that might also be another way to interpret this picture. I'm also stunned in both the 46 paintings by the incredible movement and dynamism. You have these figures going out in various directions, and yet they're part of the same vortex. And I think that kind of movement and dynamism is really quite remarkable in these paintings, and very, very characteristic of Jacob Lawrence's work. The painting in the middle is about 10 years later, and I was interested, I think, on the website for the Hirshhorn. They talk about these three paintings of Jacob Lawrence is showing people at work and at play, and I think that's a rather a positive, upbeat description of the paintings, because in South Africa, yes, they're at work, but not voluntarily, and at least not under the conditions that they were. And here, they're at play, but I don't know if you agree with me, but I find something rather sinister about this composition. I love all of the activity. I love all of the almost collage of images. I love the way he's used his color. And to some extent, I'm a little mystified by exactly how to interpret this. It's the 1950s now, 1956. This is not a perfect time. In the United States, if you recall, the mid-50s, we have had some accomplishments in terms of dealing with the race problem, but certainly things were not looking terribly positive in 1956. You had the 1954 decision, Brown versus the Board of Education. You had the bus boycott. You had the previous to that, you had the story of Emmett Till. And so while there were big earth-shaking events, not a lot of positive things had happened to really improve the situation. The schools were still not desegregated and so on. And so looking at this, you've got these two guys. It's a very male image. I presume that the subject of the pool parlor comes from his Harlem days and from the series he did in the early 40s where he depicted Harlem as a neighborhood and all the various activities that went on. And certainly the pool parlor was one of the places where young men convened. And so here you have a figure who looks pretty desperate. He's got the cue ball there, the eight ball is there. I don't know a whole lot about pool. There may be some pool experts in the audience, and you can fill me in. But my assumption, what I understand, is that to win, you have to get all the balls into the pockets first, and then the eight ball. And so this guy is... as in the phrase, behind the eight ball. But not only is he behind the eight ball, there is a very ominous character behind him who is breathing down his neck and presumably hoping that that he'll miss getting the balls in and this gentleman will be able to take over the situation and win. For me, what's kind of a puzzle is the figures that you see in the background. There are a number of boxers, including this little boxer here. You may have to come up close to look at that, who is a one-legged boxer, and clearly that is not a good way to start. That is not a good situation for a boxer. And maybe, you know, it's similar to this situation for the pool player. Up here, I mean, I've decided this must be Jack Johnson just because he's wearing those funky sort of tights that they were in the old days. And maybe this is James Jeffries, who was his opponent in the fight of the century. But here you have two African-American fighters, because we know what the complexion of the white fighter looks like, and these two, I think, are both African-American. So I don't know whether we go to Joe Louis and Ezra Charles and so on, just not sure, but it's interesting that this is the background, and I guess this is all about it's all about struggle and taking chances. You've got one die here. You've got these little pieces that are used to keep the score. So it's a very tense situation where we're not sure what the outcome is going to be. So anyway, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. But I would say that these are really wonderful examples of Jacob Lawrence's work. This one in the 50s, I think, is of particular interest because, remember, in the mid-50s, we're already into the abstract expressionists and so on. There's a lot of pressure to be doing something more avant-garde. But I think what you have here with the kind of very unconventional design, composition, the use of color, the flatness, the immediacy of the subject, that altogether... That equaled modernism and contemporaneity You know what I mean. As well as did the abstract work that was becoming so popular at the time. And in any case, I think that these are great examples of Lawrence because you've got something that is wonderful to look at. You've got great stories that are not so obvious that you don't have to really spend time with them. You've got compositions that are remarkably dynamic and interesting and engaging, and I think as a sampling of his work, they provide a very good representation, and I hope that this will be, if you're not as familiar as you might like to be with his work, that this will be, this will whet your appetite for more. So with that, I'd like to open up for questions. Anybody who'd like to venture? Yes, please. Yes.
But some of his other works, you do have the ladder in there. And also, another observation seems to me that many of the paintings, you have more than one piece, one person in there. And they are not really coordinated. They're there. Could it be that you mentioned that you had a passion that maybe he had different personalities? And so some of these paintings, because you have so many different people in it, or four or five, that they actually represent him in one way or another.
Well, that's one interpretation. The question is about the use of ladders in his work and also the fact that there are often several figures and whether or not that might reflect his difficulties when he had his period of depression in the late 40s. I don't think so. He was certainly challenged, and as I said, I think he had a lot of reason to be stressed. So much success coming to him so early, feeling guilty about his colleagues not getting the same recognition. So I don't think it was ever a question of his, you know, having a split personality or anything of that sort. I think he prefers images with figures because I think he likes to work with that interaction. And I think he thinks often of situations that are collaborative, as we see with the miners and as we see with the carpenters and with that whole series of builders. And often because it is a story, and usually stories involve more than one person. So I think those are the reasons why you see multiple figures in his in most of his compositions. Yes, sure.
Do you know his connection with his mother? Because there, I'm thinking of one particular painting where there are levels of family situation, and then he's sort of at the bottom of a stairway.
The Harlem painting?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, he didn't have the easiest family life, and I'm looking at my watch here. He was born in New Jersey, and his family moved to Philadelphia, and they had very hard times. His father left, and his mother, by that time, with three children, went to New York to find work and left the three children in foster care. And I think that was a very hard time for him because he was, 10 to 13, I think, and he had to look after the younger kids. And I think that was a big burden, and I think there was always a little bit of insecurity. On the other hand, he was very close to his mother. She was the one who encouraged him to go to the art classes and to immerse himself in something creative and positive. So I think all in all, he had a very, very positive relationship with her. Other questions? And then you.
You mentioned his struggles with depression.
Yes.
And I wonder if that was at all linked to the fact that he broke through in the big-time art world so young. I assume professionally he was surrounded by people who'd been in that world for a long time, were probably older. I was wondering if he was at all comfortable with, you know, the society of his peers.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that may have contributed to some maladjustment socially and put a lot of
Yes. In fact, in 1946, and I'm not sure whether before or after, but I'm guessing after, at least for this painting, he spent the summer in Asheville, North Carolina with Jacob Albers. And that was a pivotal experience for him because Albers was all about the mechanics of art and picture making and brought the theories of the Bauhaus and so on. But it was, I think that was, it opened up a world, but I think it also perhaps created a little bit of stress and worry. And it was in the South. Joseph Albers had to rent a special railroad car to keep the Lawrences. By that time, Lawrence was married to Gwendolyn Lawrence. And to keep them from having to travel in a segregated car, he had to rent a car to bring them down. And evidently, they never left the campus of Black Mountain College because they were so afraid to expose themselves to that situation. So, and I think, as you say, it's a lot of pressure to be the most successful Black artist, and to some extent, as far as the white art world was concerned, the only one. So that would have been that would have involved a lot of pressure. Other questions? Yes.
Just two very brief comments. It's very interesting when I look at the two drawings on the ends that the people are engaged in, obviously in struggle. When I look at these figures, these guys look like they are almost positioned in positions of warfare.
Yes, it is interesting, yes.
And so those two, when you think about the time socially, you think about them struggling with social dynamics that existed at the time, and perhaps they're struggling, or their work is a part of that struggle. It's like they're using their work as a way to struggle against perhaps social ills.
Yes, I think that could very well be the case. You know, this is 1946. You know, it's after the end of World War II, and again, you'll know from all those stories of about the Black soldiers and the Tuskegee Flyers and so on. The Black soldiers came back thinking that the world would be different for them, and after all, they had been abroad saving the world for democracy, and they came back, and the status quo still was still the situation. So I think that is interesting. I think part of it is also just his design choice. I mean, there's a kind of way it's almost as if they are spokes off of this hub in the way that that they are positioned. But clearly, what you say, I mean, here hiding behind a barrier and so on, that could very well be the case. A very interesting interpretation.
Well, I think, usually,
yes, please.
When you think of heroic portraiture, there are very classic poses.
Yes. Yes, it is interesting. Yeah. Well, I think in all of his series, all of the historic series that he did, it's always about, it's a big story, but it's always told from the perspective of the individual. And I think that this is true in these paintings as well, regardless of what the symbolism is. And one of the commentators spoke about the fact that that Lawrence always said that he was not it was not about description. It was really about symbolism, and it wasn't about reality. It was about it wasn't about realism. It was about reality, which is to say that he gets at the essence of things in a way that may seem just representational, but in fact, it's something that is much, much deeper and speaks in a much more universal way than one might imagine from the specifics of any given composition. Any other comments or please, by all means.
My take on the centerpiece here is that, certainly there was a time that Poole
there was a lot of gambling associated with it. And so it's certainly, when I see the boxes, it almost is like a metaphor that the two gentlemen that are actually in the pool game are like pugilists. They're in battle with one another.
Yes, yes.
And probably there's money on the table, on the line for the winner.
Yes, I think you're probably very right. And also, if I understand it, people do bet on pool and they bet on prize fights. And in some ways, because this was such a difficult moment when it seemed that the civil rights movement was almost at a standstill, to keep in mind these guys who had the courage to fight, especially if you think about Jack Johnson, who one could have imagined that he wouldn't have even survived after his fight with James Jeffries, that they were willing to stand up in public and take a stand and defend themselves against very difficult odds. So maybe they are a metaphor for the kind of struggle and the kind of courage that one that was required in 1956 to make some important things happen. Any other comments? Or it doesn't have to be a question. I'm interested to hear what other people have found in these works because they're so rich and so complex. I think there are probably a million interpretations. Sure.
You said you didn't know a lot about pool, but in this particular game, the way it works is when the pack of balls is broken and they're spread on the table, one player ends up assigned the strap balls, and one player ends up balls. And each player can only play
work with
balls.
Uh-huh.
He has to work around the other guy's ball. And I notice in this picture there's an equal number of solid and striped balls. So apparently, in reality, they're exact peers. They're exact equals.
Yes.
But they don't like that.
Yes.
They're desperately and in a very focused way looking for some way to prove that one is better than the other.
Yes.
And I think that may reflect an urge that some privilege that they have to respect outside that pool ball. Only they're on the short end of that.
Well, I mean, that's brilliant. That's interesting interpretation.
You know, to just go along with that, when I look at the poses of the boxers, certainly the skill of the pool player, you have to be good. You have to be confident in the game to go to a level of betting.
You have to be good with your hands,
right,
among other things.
And so the boxers, in some stances, look to be more of a defensive stance, and some are offensive. And still relating to the pool game is that sometimes you're on offense, and sometimes you have to play defensively.
Great. Thank you. Any other comments or questions? Do I see a hand almost going up there? No. Okay. Thank you all very much. It's been fun to have you. And I hope you'll continue to seek out Jacob Lawrence's works and try to sort them out. Thank you.
Thank you.